May it please the Court. The appellant's injuries in this case arose out of the respondent's negligence in failing to safeguard its property, failing to prevent an unauthorized third party's acquisition and use of its property, and having a general lack of adequate security. Trial court in the underlying case before this equitable garnishment case found that those breaches directly caused the appellant's injuries, and that they were incident to the general business of the insured. The respondent insurer, however, insists that an exclusion designed to exclude claims for injuries arising out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of an automobile exclude coverage for the appellant's injuries.
At the time of that the car was removed from the lot, is it known or agreed between the parties as to what this guy's status was?
As to which guy's status?
The employee, ex-employee, the one who died in the crash?
That's not agreed, but in the underlying judgment, the trial court discussed both potential options, whether he was an existing employee or not an existing employee. Now, at this time, in their brief, the respondent here says that he was not an employee. That's fine. We're willing to go with that. I think it doesn't matter.
You think
matter
it doesn't matter?
It doesn't matter for the purposes of our argument whether he was an employee at the time or not. His use was unauthorized.
Except the exclusion says something about supervision of employees or something, doesn't it?
That's the second paragraph of the exclusion, okay, which is dependent on the first paragraph. And that's one of the ambiguities that we're here on, is how the second and first paragraphs relate. The first paragraph says it excludes anything arising out of the ownership, maintenance, use of an automobile. The second paragraph says this exclusion applies if the occurrence involved the ownership, maintenance, or use of an automobile and had to do with, as you say, supervision, entrustment, et cetera, of the insured. But it doesn't really matter for our purposes whether he was an employee or not. His use was unauthorized, and the trial court in the underlying case expressly found that the insured had reported the vehicle as stolen to the Lee Summit Police Department, stolen from its own lot. The trial court found, and it's final for the purposes of this case, that the use was unauthorized. So those were the breaches. The insured's breaches didn't have anything to do with arising out of the ownership, maintenance, or use of an automobile. They're totally separate. They're incident to the general business of the insured and not actually the ownership, maintenance, or use of an automobile.
Part of your claim is that they left the vehicle parked with its keys in it. Doesn't that conduct arise out of the ownership of the vehicle?
Your Honor, the question isn't whether the ownership or maintenance or use was part of it. We're willing to admit that that may have been a separate cause, right? A separate proximate cause of the injury was, you know, the ownership of that automobile. But had the insured not breached their duties by failing to prevent the unauthorized third party's use of the property, or just, as the trial court said, quote, a lack of adequate security, which caused the thief's ability to gain access.
And the lack of adequate security is related to how the vehicle was stored.
Yes, but the trial court went into numerous ways in which they lacked security. For example, yes, as you mentioned, failing to properly safeguard the vehicle and safeguard its keys, failing to prevent an unauthorized third party from using and acquiring it, and they just didn't have adequate security measures in place. Now, what we're talking about here, though, is a specific exclusion. And exclusions in Missouri in insurance contracts always have to be explicit. You can't read into them things that aren't there. And nothing about security is in this particular insurance contract. And this is why we rely on the Centermark case from the Eastern District. Because in that case, the court also found that where there's independent negligence in failing to comply with certain security procedures that are normal in the ordinary course of business, the ownership of an automobile is incidental. And that's exactly what we're talking about here. It didn't have to be an automobile that was on the lot. It could have been a chainsaw or a gun or some other dangerous piece of property that we all know to be dangerous.
But it happened to be an automobile.
In this case, it happened to be an automobile. But it's not. The breaches aren't incident to the ownership of an automobile. They're incident to the general business of the insured. And that's why we're here today, because it's an ambiguity.
But you're also here because there's a whole line of cases from the Western District that say just the opposite, that the exclusionary clause does apply and liability is dependent upon the negligent action of a driver.
That's true, Your Honor, but the problem with those cases is those can't really be squared with Missouri's general public policy of construing insurance contracts when there is an ambiguity in favor of coverage and against the drafter. And we've been doing that for, you know, over a century in this state, and that's it's pretty standard. We in our brief, we mentioned an opinion by Learned Hand in 1947 where he talks about that as well. What we're dealing with here are two ideas of causes. The trial court found that the causes here was failure to safeguard, failure to have adequate security. That's not covered. Now, I'm sorry, that's not excluded. Perhaps if you can construe it as the injuries arose out of the ownership of an automobile as a separate and equal proximate cause, that would be excluded. So what you have are these two dueling clauses. And the split you're talking about in the Eastern and Western districts is what you do when you have those two clauses. I submit that in Missouri, where we already have this very long-standing public doctrine that when an insurance contract doesn't specifically write something out, you can't read it to write that thing out. When you have these two dueling causes, you construe it in favor of coverage, certainly for the cause which is covered and is not mentioned in the exclusion.
And you're relying in part on the cases, the concurrent cause cases, which state that if there's two causes and had either one not existed, the incident would not have occurred.
That's correct.
Then you can recover damages from that covered cause.
That's exactly correct. And that first was applied in Missouri in 1983 in the Braxton case, which we discussed extensively in both our opening brief and our reply.
But wouldn't it apply for the 100 years prior to that also? There's lots and lots of cases addressing concurrent causes in many different contexts.
It does. The problem was before Braxton, it appears, there was nothing actually directly on point in Missouri. So what the Eastern District did in Braxton was it looked around the country and found, well, in all the other jurisdictions.
There wasn't an insurance case, you mean?
Yeah, there wasn't an insurance case.
There were lots of cases addressing concurrent causes.
That's correct. And actually, we mentioned a case which is kind of off the point a little bit because it's not about insurance. It's the Callahan case, Callahan versus the Cardinal Glennon Hospital in St. Louis. And it was Judge Elwood Thomas, and he goes into a very long discussion about the famous two fires idea in law school. And he says you can have a case where there are two concurrent approximate causes. And, of course, that case discussed it kind of in dicta in terms of is there a but-for causation test or not. But clearly in Missouri, we have this idea that you can have two proximate causes. Now, applying that to an insurance case like this one, where one of those causes is covered and one is excluded, well, you still go with coverage because that's how we read insurance contracts. Unless something is specifically excluded, explicitly, you construe it strictly against the drafter and in favor of coverage.
Isn't the Cardinal Glennon case contrary to your argument? Because you had two fires burning up the mountain, and either one would have consumed at the top. And here, you have an automobile being driven recklessly. And without that, and that is excluded, without that, you have no injury.
I wouldn't quite see it that way. I think if you're talking about but-for causation like they do in the Callahan case, but for the respondent's insured's negligence in failing to secure its property, there would have been no use of an automobile.
There are two different ways the words concurrent causation is used in cases to refer to different things. Sometimes it's used to refer to the fact, as you're using it here, that if you have two causes and if one of them had not been present, the incident wouldn't have occurred. They work together to cause the problem. There's other ones that say you look and see whether they independently would have caused it. They seem to be just using the same term but in two very different ways.
But applying the facts of this case, Your Honor, in the underlying judgment, there's no discussion of ABC, the insured, being liable because they used an automobile or owned an automobile. They're liable because they didn't have adequate security. And for the purposes of a subsequent equitable garnishment case like this, we have to view that as final. We have to view that as the taken facts of the case, especially since the respondent had the opportunity to control and manage the litigation.
And can you, in your very short time, address that issue? The control, is this a Lodoginski kind of case, or is this a case where was that settlement under the statute, and Gulf v. Noble says that you get to redetermine reasonableness and damages.
I think it is more of a Lodoginski kind of case because the respondent chose affirmatively not to to appeal, not to do any post-trial motions, and now they raise this issue about fraud and reasonableness, as you say, of the price of the 3065 agreement. They cert if they really believed there was fraud, they had a year under Rule 7406B to go back into court after the equitable garnishment case.
So you're saying we should treat this as a case where they were present at trial and had a chance to litigate it and can't?
Certainly, Your Honor. The correspondence, as they say, speaks for itself.
Was there? But do I understand correctly? They're claiming that they did not know about the settlement until after this period of time, that you didn't inform them about it until after that time had run?
Your Honor, I'm not sure what they're saying because when they do discuss
What did happen? Did they know about the settlement?
I believe that they did know about the settlement. That's not in the record one way or another, and they don't put it in the record either.
Is there evidence of you giving them notice of the settlement prior to the time for appeal when you're saying they should be considered in the case?
They were in regular correspondence with the insurance counsel, and we have a whole bunch of that correspondence in the record regarding the reservation of rights and whether there was none or there was. They clearly, on page 156 of the legal file, there's a fax cover sheet where the respondent's counsel talking to the insurance counsel says that, hey, by the way, an answer is due today, so you might want to seek another extension. They clearly knew what was going on in the case below. They were following it, corresponding back and forth. So I don't really think they can use it at this point.
As a matter of fact, whether there were negotiations going on or not, the actual settlement that was eventually reached on the underlying case was not reached until after they had already agreed to defend without a reservation of rights.
I believe that's true.
So there may have been some talk, which may be in their best interest to say, well, this was really done before it was done. But is there really any dispute that the actual settlement itself was not consummated until after they had decided to defend without a reservation of rights?
I don't believe there is a dispute to that, no, Your Honor.
Thank you.
Thank you.
To please the court, in my humble opinion, I always try and guess why the court takes cases, and this one I think I'm right. We've got a problem between the Eastern District and the Western District in construing exclusions in insurance policies. I cannot reconcile the budget rent-a-car case and the Centermark case, and at the lower court they had difficulty with it too. Those cases seem to be very, very similar. Unauthorized use of a vehicle that was stolen, resulting in some injuries to someone. And when I look at this this situation, I was trying to come up with a solution to give you, but that's actually your job. So here are my thoughts about that. The concurrent cause doctrine can be interpreted in any number of ways. We know from Prosser on Torts and Law School, concurrent causes can concur to cause injuries. But in the context of automobile coverage, and for that matter, homeowners coverage, let me make this observation. It is basic that insurance carriers have written coverage for autos, and they have also written coverage for homeowners and commercial general liability. Auto coverage is always intended to cover automobile accidents because that's a special risk. CGLs and homeowners are to cover your other liabilities, whether you're a business or a homeowner. And what's happened, not only here in Missouri but in other states, is over the years, starting in the 80s, if there wasn't enough auto coverage, and I applaud plaintiffs bar, they were very creative in saying, okay, in the homeowner's context, you negligently entrusted your vehicle, separate negligence triggered the policy, get more coverage. The same is true with CGL. So what happened was in the 90s, the insurance industry, you all will know, came in and wrote negligent entrustment out of homeowners policies, wrote it out of CGL policies. Then the theory of negligent supervision of employees in the business context started to surface in a lot of these cases here in this state and in other states. And in 2001, the insurance industry again wrote what we have now in this case, another part to that exclusion, saying, by the way, if you're claiming negligence in supervision, training, control, et cetera, of others, and it arises out of an automobile accident, we don't cover it. So what I'm telling you is that what's happened between the 80s and now is sort of a give and take, a yo-yo, if you will, between the plaintiff's bar and the insurance industry. How can we trigger coverage? How can we plead into coverage when it's clearly an auto accident? How can we get coverage?
But why isn't it, assuming all that to be the case and to apply in the case of authorized users or those who were employees who were badly trained and had accidents, or here we have theft, allegedly, an unauthorized user who's come in, and that's very different. That's not something within the insured's control except by security. It's not by training, not by teaching someone how to drive, not by having a safer automobile. Why isn't that? Maybe it's possible to write a policy that would exclude that, but why would it not be a different legal issue whether or not it's excluded by a policy that was really written to exclude negligently supervised or trained employees or authorized users who shouldn't have been?
Sure. Justice Smith, I'll answer that this way, and I think this is raised in our brief. Sometimes there's confusion between the theory on which a case is brought and the actual cause of an injury. And that's an important distinction. We can plead lots of theories, negligently failing to secure the vehicle, negligently supervising employees, et cetera. But the real cause of the damage and injury is the use of the vehicle. And in one sense, I would say to this court, you don't even need to get to the exclusion where it talks about supervision, training, et cetera. When it says in the exclusion itself, that we don't cover bodily injury arising out of ownership, maintenance, use, or entrustment to others of any auto.
But why does this involve those? Doesn't it? I mean, if under their theory, there are lots of cases in Missouri, and I don't know if other states have this law or not, but I look back at many of them over the last 100 years, and where there's two concurrent causes, if one is within your control, the other may even be a sequential cause, not just two independent ones, but one, and which is what's alleged here. We have found in many prior cases those are concurrent causes, and you can recover for the injuries. It's not the one we learn in law school, but it is long Missouri law.
Justice Smith, I understand and appreciate your comment, and I'll respond two ways. One, the insurance policies keep getting longer, and we can try and come up with language that would exclude everything that we as lawyers can possibly think of. On the other hand, there's a clamor for more readable policies. So there's a trade-off, number one. Number two, to answer your question about the law, when you have concurrent causes, I think you have to decide, I think the law is it an independent concurring cause, or is it incidental to, in this case, the use of a vehicle? If it's totally independent, then I think the concurring cause line of thought applies. If you have two totally independent potential negligent acts, then I think you might be able to apply that. But if it's incidental to the use of a vehicle, i.e. leaving the keys in a car, and let me give you an example. I have a couple teenage children. I know one of them is a terrible driver. Lots of tickets, lots of accidents. I'm furious. I banned him from using the car. My other teenage child is okay. I come home from work and I leave my keys on the keychain where the family gets them. And my bad actor steals the car, even though I forbid him to do that. It's not permissive use. He shouldn't have it. He goes out and he runs into somebody. Under the Eastern District view, or this case, as the appellant would have you believe, my homeowner's policy would probably be triggered in the Eastern District. In the Western District, I don't think it would be, because that leaving the keys there somewhat available was only incidental, if you will, to the use of the vehicle. It wasn't independent of the use of the vehicle.
But of course, we're dealing with the business and security, and not just leaving the keys, which certainly is a closer case. I agree, but failing to provide in general prevent unauthorized users. So it wasn't your kid, but it was someone who came in your home and stole the keys, and you had a sign out there saying, "Here, keys inside," or whatever, which I think sometimes we. There's a Missouri case from 1966, Supreme Court case, that says if some injury is reasonably to be anticipated, it is reasonably probable as a result of, as a result of defendant's act of negligence, then an added act of a third person, though he's also negligent, does not break the chain of causation. It's basically saying it doesn't have to be just two independent ones. It's one after the other. I think it is a different legal situation, and I agree, but that's a Missouri Supreme Court 1966 case, not an insurance case.
Yeah.
This doctrine, at least at times in the past, has been interpreted broadly enough to include sequential concurrent causes.
You know, and I don't disagree, and I can't reconcile. I've tried to reconcile all these cases, try to come up with how can you have the Centermark case and the budget rental car case, and I can't. Mm-hmm. Because the term concurrent cause has been interpreted differently in different cases. Some
right.
cases
mm-hmm.
say, I keep coming back to this point, but yep. some cases say if it's incidental to the use of the vehicle, then it's not really a concurrent cause.
So we really just kind of have to make a policy decision and try to reconcile these in a way that at least people will know in the future.
I think that's a very difficult task mm-hmm. for this court, but I think it needs to be done. There's some, you know, some recent cases, and I wondered why this case, you all decided to take this case as opposed to the Green case or some others, but it seems to me the weight of the state with respect to the lower appellate courts has been to side with the Western District reasoning, which I think is solid reasoning, because, and particularly when you're talking about automobiles. I can see a different situation if you have an assault and battery exclusion or something like that. It may be a little different, but when you're dealing with an automobile, how does the injury and damage occur, regardless of this act of negligence, this act, and finally somebody's got the vehicle? It arises out of, if you will, the ownership, operation, or use of the vehicle.
Sir, your opponent says that the exclusionary clause doesn't exclude this specific action, and at best it's ambiguous. As the drafter of the policy, why shouldn't we construe that policy against you?
Well, I answer that two ways. One, I think the first paragraph excludes this particular accident. The injuries in this case arose out of the ownership, operation, and use of the vehicle. And then what you're asking me, Justice Russell, is the second part, where we say, we all know what it is, it's supervision, training. We try and throw everything else we can think of in there to avoid triggering coverage under a CGL for automobile accidents. And I'll respond the same way I did to Justice Stith. That laundry list literally could become 100 pages if we could think of everything to exclude.
Could you just say theft?
Well, theft is excluded. Stolen automobiles are excluded under auto policies,
different
too.
Mm-hmm.
The problem is it is a policy decision. Do we want to require that insurance carriers who write auto policies to insure autos and CGLs to insure other business interests to come back and write 100-page exclusions on autos just to be sure? And I guarantee you, even if that were done, plaintiffs' lawyers are good. They'll come up with another act of negligence. That's why we have this string of cases that we have not only in this state but the state of Kansas and all over the place, where, and I commend them, plaintiffs' lawyers have been able to get coverage under non-auto policies for injuries. But at some point in time, you have to look at it and say, wait a minute, does concurrent cause really trigger coverage under a CGL or under homeowners in an automobile context? I don't know that you have to address other types of injuries with this case.
Mr. McCormick, let me ask you a question about the reservation of rights mm-hmm. issue. I understand your argument is that they've waived that below in the trial court in the summary judgment proceedings, but do you agree that the facts as set out in page 62 of the appellate's briefs about what they did say below is accurate, and then it would just be for us to decide whether or not that was a waiver?
Well, Justice Fisher, and this will answer a question you asked earlier too, I think. The way this case came down was Westport denied coverage, then tendered a reservation, tendered a defense under a reservation, which the day after it was tendered was rejected. Then the plaintiff went to court on a 537065 without any notice to Westport, got a $1.4 million judgment or a $1.37 million judgment, without any further notice to Westport.
Did they have an obligation under their contract once you'd only offered to defend under reservation and they'd rejected it?
No, they can reject it.
Okay.
They can reject it. Yeah. But what I'm getting at is and then that was on actually August 29th of 06 that they took the judgment. We didn't know about it. And then on 9/22, September 22nd, almost a month later, another letter came from us saying, okay, we'll take the defense and we'll withdraw our reservation. Obviously, we didn't know they had gotten $1.4 million judgment.
Is that in the record? That you didn't know about the underlying judgment?
I believe so.
How would it be in there? Is there a letter, or how could it? How would it be in the record?
Well, it's sort of a reverse implication. We wouldn't agree to accept liability when there was already $1 million.
Or you might think, gosh, we better kind of cover our tracks. I mean, either way is certainly possible. I mean, I don't tend to decide cases on things that aren't in the record. And that's what troubles me about this particular issue. And, I've tried to look at it from both your side and their side and to see if there's any agreement between the two of you as to what the facts are regarding the preservation of that issue.
Well, let me tell you, this case got to summary judgment before we actually did discovery on those issues. There are some fraud, collusion, reasonableness of the verdict issues still in this case. But we took a shot at the coverage issue first before we got into all that can of worms. To answer your question, I'm confident what happened, but I don't think you can find from the record that you have what I'm telling you, Justice Fisher. So,
What does the record show about once you offer to defend without a reservation of rights? The opposing counsel notes there were still, I think, 8 days before the judgment was final. And then an appeal time, and you did not take advantage of those. So aren't we left with you saying we're defending it without a reservation, and you didn't try to withdraw that before the case was final?
And again, discovery wasn't completed on that, but I will represent to the court that we were still not told of the judgment in response to that letter.
So you're saying there are fact issues about what occurred during that period that would affect...
Absolutely. I mean,
who's knowledge here? Who had what
the appeal
knowledge?
Time ran, if you will, and then we learned of the judgment, and the equitable garnishment was filed almost immediately. And I'm not casting aspersions. I'm just saying, you know, maybe that's a good way to do it. But when we said we'll take this case without a reservation, we had no idea that a judgment had been entered and didn't know until after the appeal time.
Would you agree that if, in fact, you were in the case without reservation of rights, then you do not get a relitigate coverage? But if you were not, then it's your argument that Noble applies and you do get a look at reasonableness and damages?
Sorry to interrupt you. Yes. If we'd been in it, we're in it for the long haul.
Thank you, counsel.
All right, thank you.
I'd like to clear up one thing about this timeline. The agreement was, the 573065 agreement was entered into before the reservation of rights was withdrawn. I was incorrect, Judge Fisher, on saying that before. The respondent says that they didn't know about that until after the summary judgment had run. That can't be because it's in our petition for equitable garnishment. And we, in fact, attached to the petition all of the correspondence that raised this issue. There was a trial in the underlying personal injury case. The insured was represented by counsel there. The letters, the correspondence between the respondent's counsel and the insurance counsel shows that they were aware of what was going on. So I don't know where they can say that they didn't know about this until after summary judgment. But all that aside, I did note that in their response, they said that the concurrent cause doctrine in Missouri is all over the place. With respect to certain causes in underlying personal injury cases, sure. But when it comes to insurance cases, they aren't. All of them, even the cases from the Western District that seem to reject this, do construe the doctrine to be the same. And that is where the insured's own negligence is a separate, concurrent, and non-excluded cause of liability, the policy provides coverage. And the Eastern District has been applying this faithfully since 1983. And as they apply it so often that in the Bowen case in 2005, the court went so far as to note that the concurrent cause doctrine is broadly accepted in Missouri. So I think, once again, and all these courts seem to point out, that it's part of our general policy of how we construe insurance contracts. But I think it's interesting that we ended up getting into the reservation of rights issue here, because that's really our point is, you know, whatever the insurance contract may mean, and we think it should be construed in favor of coverage, they lost the chance to litigate about this and disclaim coverage a long time ago when they withdrew their reservation of rights and did nothing thereafter. If there are any more questions.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
The case is submitted.